Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. What does President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal mean for the region, for our allies, and for us? And how might it relate to what many see as a proxy war in neighboring Yemen? Joining me to discuss these issues is Rob Malley. He's CEO of the International Crisis Group and a former senior director of the National Security Council under President Obama. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. My conversation with Rob Malley took place on May 9, one day after the president announced his decision regarding the Iran nuclear deal. And now to my conversation with Rob Malley. So the president has announced that we're withdrawing from the Iran nuclear agreement. He laid out sort of three issues that concerned him, and I'm wondering whether they could have been addressed without pulling out of the agreement. So they were concerned about the sunset clause, that in 15 years they could ultimately resume a nuclear program. Second concern about two issues that weren't part of the agreement, their ballistic missile program and their activities in the region, their support for Hezbollah and others. Take the first, and this is concern about the sunset clause. Could this have been addressed, or would we be better off in the agreement or out of the agreement, given that concern?
Let's first set the context. The deal had one purpose, and really one purpose only, which was to address the problem of Iran developing a nuclear program, which at the time, people like the Prime Minister of Israel were saying was the single most important threat that Israel faced. People in the United States were saying that we would have to go to war if we allowed Iran to expand its program. So that was the goal. How do we put this program in a box?
And Iran was, what, months away from?
At the time, we said, you know, there's this odd concept of breakout time, which is how much time Iran would need to develop the fissile material, the material it needs to build a bomb. It still was further away in terms of militarizing it, but it was about, say, 2-3 months from having enough, if it wanted to accelerate its program, mm-hmm. to get enough enriched uranium to build a bomb. So that was the goal. It achieved that goal. Now, there's some things it didn't achieve. It's true. So you mentioned two, missiles and regional activity. I could get to that in a second. The question of the sunsets, and this was a question, it's not as if we didn't think about it. There probably was no issue that we negotiated more arduously than this one, which was, for how long are these restrictions going to last? Iran's position was a few months. You know, we're going to stop our program. We'll have some confidence-building measures. And then we should be treated like any country under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which actually doesn't restrict. People could enrich as much as to their heart's content. There's no restriction other than developing a bomb. Our position was, at the time, 20 years or 25, I forget how we started off, with 30 years for certain things. Some restrictions we said have to last forever. The prohibition on developing or acquiring a bomb, the joining the additional protocol, which means subjecting them to the most rigorous inspections regime that currently exists. So those were things that would go on forever. Other things would last 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 25 years. Some of the most important restrictions, how much they could enrich, to what level, those last about 15 years. But see, the logic we had was, let's at least put this problem in a box, if not forever, and we did think it could be forever if Iran mm-hmm. complied with what it said it was going to comply with. It could always cheat. But that's true if you have the, you know, even if President Trump tomorrow develops a deal where they agree to not do anything forever, they could cheat. That's not, you know, the facts mm-hmm. on paper. It's the verification, and it's whatever trust you can build or not. So the problem with what President Trump has done is he may not like the restrictions because in 12, 15 years they're going to loosen up. Today, if Iran wants, it could reciprocate what President Trump has done and say, we're going to withdraw too, no restrictions. So the problem that you're afraid of in 15 years comes to your doorstep today.
Right. And if you have the agreement in place, you've got these extraordinary restrictions, sort of 24/7 surveillance right. of their program, but also the ability to go to any military site as well as a weapons development site. And my understanding is that every day the IAEA is analyzing dust from all, you know, who knows where in Iran. Am I wrong about that?
Again, with the IAEA, which is the International Atomic Energy Agency, the agency that is monitoring the implementation of this agreement, and which has now said, I think, roughly 10 times since 2016, since they've monitored, that Iran is rigorously implementing the deal. It has said, and I think, again, all objective experts would agree, it's the most intrusive verification mechanism that any sovereign state has accepted. a defeated state in war might have to accept more. Yeah. But any state that has negotiated a deal, this is the most intrusive. As you say, it has cameras, it has the ability, if the IAEA wants to visit any suspect site. It can't do it on a whim. It has to show that there's some basis. And then there's an amount of time where Iran could say, well, we don't want you to come here because it's too sensitive. We want you to go there. If by the end the IAEA is not convinced, it says, no, we want to visit this site. Either Iran says yes, or if it says no, it's in violation and the sanctions come back. So, that, again, it's one of those myths that there's no-go areas. There's no no-go area. Every area is subject to inspection if that's what the IAEA wants. And all of that, if Iran today, which it hasn't done yet, fortunately, decides in retaliation to what President Trump has done, that it too is going to walk away, then it expels the inspectors, it resumes its enrichment program, and we face the conundrum that President Obama wanted to avoid, which is, do we let Iran move towards a bomb, or do we bomb Iran?
Right, right. The reason I'm focusing on the verification portions of the agreement is I'm trying to figure out, are we better off or worse off, right, when it comes to that problem, that 15-year sunset? With the agreement, we'll know in pretty much intimate detail how close they are to enriching more uranium. Without it, what do we know?
We have no eyes, we have no ears. I mean, this is, and again, I can't claim to be a nuclear expert, but one of the things President Obama said to us when we went to negotiate the deal was, whatever you bring back, I'm not going to take your word for it. I want our best atomic experts to look at it and to tell us, they're going to road test it and tell us, does this meet the bar that they have set, that Iran has to be for at least 10 years, a year away from that breakout capacity. Right. So we went from a few months, we're now more than 12 months, but he wanted a minimum of 12 months for a minimum of 10 years, which is what we brought back. And that was tested. And for Iran to be able, under the deal, if it respects it, for it to be able to cheat, and it would have to cheat at so many levels. It would have to get more enriched uranium, it would have to enrich it at higher levels, it would have to build the centrifuges. So even if it cheated in one place, even two places, and undetected, it would have to cheat in four or five, and somebody, the IAEA would detect it, we would detect it, one of our partners would detect it, so they really couldn't cheat. I don't think, and if you listen to what the critics of the deal say, in fact, I heard Prime Minister Netanyahu say the other day, they weren't afraid that Iran would violate the deal. Their fear was that Iran would respect it, and then in 15 years, maybe develop a bomb. So nobody is challenging that this, as it stood, it was a very good deal. There are questions about what happens after certain restrictions expire, and there's questions about things that have nothing to do with the deal, like the ballistic missile program and regional activity, which we could get into. But again, the sunset, there was a way to address it. It wasn't by tearing up a deal, which now puts Iran in a position where there's no restriction theoretically that applies other than if it wants to voluntarily abide by the deal. The way to, if there was that concern, which is not an illegitimate one, even though I think it's exaggerated, the way to do it is, let's implement the deal in good faith for a year, 2 years, then let's go to Iran and say, you know what, there's still things you want from us. We haven't removed that primary embargo. We still have no trade, with a small exception until yesterday, of aviation. No, and we could buy pistachios and rugs. But other than that, there's no commerce between the U.S. And trade in Iran. Yeah. That's something Iran wants. The other things they want, okay, come to the table. What we want is for these sunsets to go on or whatever. But that's the way to do it, not to say we're tearing up the deal that actually restrains your activities for 15, 20, 25, 30 years. So we're doing that away, and now we want to negotiate a deal that's going to be worse for you when we've just shown that our word is not to be taken at face value. And we're not going to give you anything more in exchange. We want to squeeze you more. You're going to get less from us, and we're not trustworthy. I don't see how that works.
So we'll talk a minute about the ways in which we're squeezing our allies as well with this announcement. But let me just go to the other two stated concerns, both the missile program and the sort of mischief in the region, support for terror groups or others in the region. Did the nuclear agreement in any way preclude our negotiating agreements in those two areas that could involve sanctions as well?
No, I mean, if anything, so again, what was the logic? We could have tried to negotiate a deal that would have told Iran no more ballistic missile tests, no more regional activity, no more support for Hezbollah, for Hamas, for interference in regional countries. Does anyone think that we could have achieved that in 2-3 years? I mean, this involves Because Iran would have come back and said, okay, you want to talk about our missile program? We want to talk about your military assistance to Saudi Arabia. You want to talk about our regional activity? We want to talk about Israel's regional activity. That would have gone on forever. And during that time, Iran would have continued to build its nuclear program.
Right, right. So, and in fact, it really actually gone nuclear in that kind of time.
Possibly. Yeah. And what, so again, President Obama's view was, let's at least take care of one problem so that we could deal with these other problems without having to deal with a nuclear-armed Iran. I mean, imagine how much harder it would be to deal with their regional activity or their ballistic missile program if they had a nuclear bomb. Yeah. So let's take that issue off the table, and then we could still deal, as you said, with terrorism, with their ballistic missile program, either through diplomacy or through sanctions, because we made clear to the Iranians in every meeting we had with them, and they pushed hard for a different result. We told them, we're going to remove all the secondary, the sanctions that apply to third countries when it comes to the nuclear program. We're going to maintain our sanctions on terrorism, on human rights, and on destabilizing activity and ballistic missiles, and we're going to impose them. We're not going to, what we couldn't do was sort of find a duplicitous way of you remove one sanction, then you put it in for a different reason. Right. That we said we wouldn't do. But if they continued with all those activities, we said we would continue to sanction them. And by the way, the Obama administration, like the Trump administration, continued to impose sanctions on Iran even after the deal was concluded.
So if those are the stated reasons, what and those stated reasons, stated objections, could have been met within the context of with us staying in the agreement, what about the potential unstated reasons? Rudy Giuliani just the other day said that the president is absolutely committed to regime change in a public speech. John Bolton, the NSC advisor, is on the record as very recently saying regime change in Iraq was a good move. Should we take those people at their word on that, take that on face value, and should Iran?
So I have no doubt that that's what John Bolton has in mind, maybe what Rudy Giuliani has in mind. I'm not sure what's in President Trump's mind, so I'm not going to speculate. I do think, and I think this is sort of a pattern that we're seeing, there's certain decisions he makes that are perfectly predictable. One, if it has to do with demolishing the inheritance, the legacy of his predecessor, that's an obsession, and he's very close to succeeding. Mm-hmm. Healthcare, climate change, Iran deal, Cuba, I mean, everything he's trying to undo. Mm-hmm. That's, for whatever reason, he's fixated on undoing his predecessor legacy. And second, he's fixated on living up to the commitments, the pledges he made during his campaign that matter to his base. Now, in theory, one would say being true to what you promised the electorate is a good thing. In this case, I wish it weren't, because what he promises his electorate was often completely irrational and bad ideas. But it is true that those are two things. If you want to know what he's going to do, the first thing to look at is what did he promise his electorate and what did President Obama do? And he look at those two, and it answers most of the questions. I think in this case, you're right. He also has around him, particularly now, but it's always been people whispering in his ear, advisors who say, you could prove that you're going to get rid of this regime. This is a regime that is the cause of all evil in the world, at least in the Middle East. So there's a way to do it, and the way to do it is to get rid of this deal. You know, I think many people gravitating around President Trump have different intentions when it comes to Iran. Some of them want to simply change the regime. Others want to squeeze it, whatever it is. He's sort of the least common, or the common denominator is they all thought this deal was a bad thing. The president obviously felt the same way for whatever reason. So that, I think, is the explanation, whether he really in his mind knows how he's going to change the regime or not, or does he think he's going to get a better deal? Because I think he also would be happy if he could show the world and show the American public that because he put maximum pressure on Iran, just as he says he did on North Korea, he could get a better deal with Tehran once he negotiates. So let's not forget, here's the same person who, on the day that he gave a speech which excoriated Iran at the last UN General Assembly meeting in September, and it was a very, very ferocious speech, that same evening, he asked President Rouhani of Iran for a meeting, which left the Iranians completely befuddled. They had no idea what was going on. I mean, on one hand, he's basically talking as if he wanted to get rid of the regime, and the next minute he says, let's get together for dinner. So they were as confused as many Americans are about how he changes his mind. But, he's somebody who I could imagine thinking, I'm going to sit down with him and I'm going to get a better deal.
So he did, at the same time as talking about pulling out of that agreement, talked about Secretary Pompeo going to North Korea. In I think for many experts in the field, they've always felt that the relationship between the Iran policy and the North Korea policy is that if we renege on the nuclear weapons deal with Iran, that'll undermine our efforts to get a deal with North Korea. President Trump seems to appears to have the opposite view, that by virtue of getting even tougher on Iran, that he is sending a signal to North Korea that you really got to deal with me. What is your interpretation?
I mean, it's interesting. I do think that's how he looks at it. I think he feels like he has to prove to the Iranians and to the North Koreans that he's different from his predecessor, that he's the one with whom you're going to make a deal. So he thinks that by reneging on the Iran deal, he's telling the North Koreans, "You see, I mean it when I say that I'm only going to do a deal that I like, that meets my threshold. So you better take me seriously." And I think he also thinks that by dealing with North Korea the way he is, he's telling the Iranians, I'm going to put pressure, and then you're going to come to the table. Now, the problem with that logic is that in some ways, it actually, you could turn it on its head. Whether the North Koreans today, looking at what President Trump did with Iran, are going to be convinced that they can't deal with the U.S. because they're not trustworthy, I don't know. But it certainly doesn't help. I mean, it's hard to see how tearing up a deal with Iran is going to convince the North Koreans that he's trustworthy. But that may, you know, regardless, the other, for me, more serious consequences are what his dealing with North Korea is going to do to the Iranians. What do they see? First of all, historically, what they see is the countries in the region that didn't have nuclear weapons or that gave up the nuclear weapon program, like Libya, are toppled. Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, and, you know, it's not over yet, but whatever's happening in Syria. Here are cases where, you know, they said the Iranians look at around the world and they say, those countries didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. Where are their leaders today? By contrast, Kim Jong-un and the Kim dynasty has a nuclear weapon. You know, they're not threatened with regime change, maybe rhetorically, but not in practice. And in fact, the president is now lavishing Kim with praise and going to negotiate with him. So I think the lesson, and you're hearing this debate now in Iran more than you ever have before, some people are saying, not officials, but others are saying, influential voices, maybe we should build a nuclear weapon. Maybe we should get out of the non-proliferation treaty. Mm-hmm. Because let's see, you know, what gives us the guarantee that we're going to survive? So I think that's one repercussion that's serious. The other thing, which is, you know, I think people are beginning to focus on, is if President Trump says that the deal with Iran is the worst deal ever and it is unacceptable, he's going to have to get a better deal with North Korea. I don't know anyone who believes that North Korea is prepared to give up, to reverse its nuclear program in the same way that Iran did, and to end up with the kind of inspections, the most intrusive inspections, with, you know, giving up for X number of years even the right to enrich over a certain amount. They have the bomb now, so they're going to go back to that level. So he's really set himself up a certain standard that's going to be very, very hard to meet, which could mean that there's no deal with North Korea, and then we could be back on the road, on the brinkmanship that we were experiencing just a few months ago.
If you think about the differences internally between a North Korea, right, and all the reasons a North Korea would not allow us that kind of access, and Iran, say something about how vulnerable Iran is right now in terms of its economy, its domestic politics. Is putting the squeeze on Iran a way in which to have the regime collapse?
You know, after the Arab uprising of 2011, which I think took almost everyone by surprise, predicting the resilience or the fragility of a regime is something I want to stay away from in order not to be contradicted the next day. That having been said, it's true the economy is not doing well, no doubt about it, and that's partly because of the fact that the United States has not lived up, even before yesterday, was not living up to its part of the bargain with Iran. The bargain was Iran is going to freeze and roll back its nuclear program. The rest of the world, in particular the U.S., is going to, if not actively encourage business with Iran, in the case of the U.S., as I said, there is none, but not discourage it. That's in the text. You just read it. It makes it clear the U.S. agreed that it would not discourage trade commerce with Iran. The Trump administration has been doing the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. Treasury Department traveling around the world warning people about doing trade with Iran. So we've already in violation of the deal even before yesterday. But what that factor, the fact that the Iranian regime is and the economy is opaque, is corrupt, there's a lot of red tape. It's not a very investment-friendly climate. They've imprisoned a number of dual citizens. So given all that, there's not been that much investment. the currency has collapsed. So this is not an economy that is doing well, mm-hmm. and it's going to be doing worse as a result of the renewed imposition of sanctions. It's also a regime that has been challenged several times in 2009 after what most people consider a rigged election, and again, mm-hmm. there were riots not long ago. Whether that leads to regime change, let's not forget it. This is a country that lived through one of the most brutal wars, the war with Iraq, you know, with hundreds and thousands of dead, and a country at that point that, you know, the entire world was with Saddam, maybe with a couple of exceptions. They survived. They are a resilient regime. They're a tough, brutal regime. So I would not wager on them falling, even if these sanctions are brutal.
And what about the fate of the more what we consider to be the more moderates, President Rouhani, Foreign Minister Zarif? These are the people that negotiated the deal, that championed the deal. What is their likely fate now that?
So I try to stay away from the word moderate, not moderate, because I'm not sure what that really means. I think there are some in Iran who believe in engagements with the West. They think that's important. They think that growing their economy will only happen by opening up. And then there are those who believe, either because they don't trust the West or because they have vested interests in a closed economy, and there are many people like that, who are against this. And that was the battle around the Iran nuclear deal. There's no doubt that the president's decision has strengthened the latter camp, those who believe the harder line, if that's what we want to call them, the people associated with the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, people who are with the military, the security services. A, because they don't trust America, and B, again, because they prefer a closed economy. They prefer to be able to say, we told you so. Let's stop this deal. Let's stop exchanges. They're afraid of outside interference because they think that's the way you sort of plant the germ that's going to then seed of contestation within their system. So this undoubtedly strengthens the second camp. Let's see the next presidential elections. There's some time to go, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they would be held today if the more hard line were to prevail.
Yeah. I'm going to turn in a minute to the issue of Iran's activities in the region, and in particular Yemen. But let me just first finally just ask you about the other signatories, Britain, Germany, France, Russia, China. What should they do? What are they likely to do, and what would they ideally do in response to this?
You know, the International Crisis Group, the group that I head for months now, have seen this coming. As I said, you know, Trump is not that unpredictable. He wanted to do away with the deal. He was persuaded to continue it for some time, but we knew he was going to do this. So we've been arguing that rather than the Europeans in particular focusing all their energy on making sure that the U.S. wasn't going to exit the deal, which proved to be a futile task, they should spend a lot of their energy trying to persuade Iran to stay in the deal, even without the United States. Now, people would say, why would Iran do that? The main party that they're concerned about is the U.S. If the U.S. reimposes sanctions, what we call secondary sanctions, it's going to freeze other countries and frighten other companies, big companies, from dealing with Iran because they don't want to be subject to sanctions.
So secondary sanctions are us sanctioning their companies.
Extraterritorial sanctions. Like, you know, a French oil company wants to do business in Iran. The U.S. imposes sanctions, says you can't. If they do, you're barred from doing business here. You're sanctioned. I mean, they've paid billions in sanctions before the sanctions were lifted years ago. So it's going to definitely make it much more difficult for Iran to get any of the benefits of the deal. But what we argued in our report, and what others are now, and what the Iranians have said yesterday, what the Europeans said yesterday, is there are ways, they're difficult, they're a bit untested, but there are ways to limit the damage that U.S. sanctions can do. For example, you can try to deal in non-U.S. denominated currency. You can pass blocking regulations, which are laws that the Europeans have already passed in the past, saying you can't abide by U.S. sanctions because they are legal, and we will protect you. We will give you some form of insurance in case you're sanctioned. The Europeans could come to the U.S. and say, if you sanction us, we're going to sanction you, so let's agree on a truce. Give us an exemption, the kind of exemptions that President Trump gave when he tried to impose tariffs on steel.
Yeah.
So I think now the discussion, the ball has moved. The other thing the U.S. has done, it's put itself offside when it comes to diplomacy and how to deal with Iran. We're now no longer the relevant party. The ball has moved to Europe and Iran. They have to come together with the means, and maybe they'll succeed, maybe they won't, to protect as much of European business as possible from the impact of secondary sanctions, to persuade businesses then that they are protected, so that Iran concludes we're better off sticking with the deal than walking away.
Yeah, yeah. So let's turn to Yemen.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a country that has had multiple wars, revolutions. It's one of the poorest, perhaps it is the poorest country in the Middle East. What was a civil war, end of 2014, beginning of 2015, has now engaged others. It's become international. Talk a little bit about what precipitated this war, and who else got involved, meaning the Iranians, the Saudis, and others, and why?
So first of all, you're right. I mean, it was the poorest country even before the war began, the poorest country in the Middle East. Imagine what it is now. You know, a few statistics, 80% of the population is in need of assistance. Over 50% lacks basic health care, clean water. It's cholera epidemic that is almost without precedent. It is the worst humanitarian situation, according to all humanitarian agencies, the worst humanitarian situation in the world. You know, obviously, Syria, far more deaths, but just in terms of the humanitarian situation itself, it's the worst in the world. Again, starting from a very low base, and now the floor has fallen.
And facing famine.
And facing famine, exactly. One of three countries in the world that are facing, four countries in the world that are facing famine today. So it's a very serious situation. How do we get there? You know, as most of these conflicts in the Middle East, it's a mix of a very local conflict. You mentioned it before. There's been civil wars in Iraq, in Yemen, between the Houthi, the northern, you know, there's a branch of Shiism, and other parts of the country. There's been also a secessionist movement in the south. So there's been battles between the central government and the Houthi, and between the north and south for quite some time. But so there's a regional there's a local conflict. Superimposed upon it is a regional conflict, which is the battle between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia that felt that the Houthi, the rebels who took over the capital in 2014-15, and were marching to take most of the country, Saudi Arabia intervened quite violently.
And on behalf of the
recognized government. On behalf of the government that had been toppled by the Houthi, the government of President Hadi, which the United States also supported. And they intervened, and they convinced the United States. I was in the administration then. It's not, I think, necessarily our proudest moment, but we assisted Saudi Arabia. Not as much as Saudi Arabia wanted, which hurt our relationship with them, but enough to be associated with this war that the Saudi-led coalition was waging against the Houthi rebels using very brutal means, with a large number of civilian casualties, and with a humanitarian impact because they imposed a virtual de facto blockade, port and airport. So much of the goods that Yemen relies on, because it really is a country that relies on imports, was cut off. So there's as they say, the local dimension, the regional dimension, and then the international dimension, because countries like the U.S. and others also get involved. And it's just become harder and harder to untangle all three. If it was just a local battle, it would be tough, it would be brutal, be violent. It's been going on for some time. But the Yemenis in the past have been able to resolve it. You add to it the regional dimension and the sectarian polarization between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the fact that for Saudi Arabia and the new leadership in Saudi Arabia, I mean, which is a very important factor, this is a war that was led by the crown prince. He was not crown prince at the time, the son of the king, Mohammed bin Salman. And his conviction, and I've had many conversations with him, and I'll try to present it as fairly as I can. His conviction is that Saudi Arabia for too long has been the punching bag. That Iran has been able to expand its influence in the region, and Saudi Arabia, which is wealthier, has a more powerful military on paper, has a more powerful network of alliances with the U.S., with Europe, has done nothing, has been passive. So he felt this is where we draw the line first. We're going to fight back. We're not going to allow what he saw as an Iranian proxy. He saw the Houthis as an Iranian proxy. I think that was exaggerated and became a self-fulfilling prophecy, but he saw them as a proxy because they did get some assistance. He said, I'm going to defeat them here, and I'm going to reassert Saudi Arabia's role in the region. Mm. I remember talking to Saudi officials at the time, and I said, be careful. These wars which we know this from Vietnam, and the Israelis know this from Gaza, and the Israelis know this from fighting Hezbollah. These wars against non-state actors, you think you could resolve them in a month or two, and they told us 3 months is all they needed. How many years later are we? Yeah. They don't end because the non-state actors, for them, they define victory as the absence of defeat. So it doesn't matter. Even if tomorrow the Saudis take over the capital, Sana'a, and expel the Houthis, as they've expelled them from other areas of the country, Even if they do that, the Houthis are not going to disappear. They now have more and more missiles, which have been provided by Iran. Because Iran, from their perspective, if you're sitting in Tehran, you think, this is fantastic. This is a low-cost war. We just have to give them a few missiles, a little bit of training. We're going to bleed the Saudis. We're going to get the Saudis embroiled in this war, in this quagmire. And therefore, they won't be able to spend as much elsewhere. And so it's been as a self-inflicted wound. And the sooner this war ends, the better for the Yemeni people, the better for Saudi Arabia, and better for the region.
Of course, the Iranians are spending in the millions, and the Saudis are spending in the billions in this war. Right. So the Saudi coalition is 9 countries, Arab and African countries. We're providing support. The Brits are providing support. We had some misgivings in the beginning, sure. If I can remember correctly, sort of a sense that too many civilians were dying, that it was unrealistic to think that this was going to be lead to a rapid victory. But how much, you know, we sold what? How much when it came to arms?
So it's, I mean, yeah, we 100 billions in
weapons. Yeah, it's over 100 billion.
So, but the real question, I struggle with it again. I mean, I was in the administration, so I it's something I try to reflect upon a lot. You know, where did things go wrong? Remember, this happened. The request for request for American assistance came in 2015, when we were in the midst of these very sensitive negotiations with Iran. Yeah. Saudi Arabia was extremely upset about it. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia already felt betrayed by the U.S. for several reasons. They felt betrayed because we were negotiating with Iran. They felt betrayed because we had supported the ouster of President Mubarak from Egypt. Yes. They felt that we were now with this popular uprising against established regimes. So they were already feeling that they couldn't trust President Obama. For them, this was really a test. Are they going to be with us when we are at war with an enemy who we feel is threatening our own territory? Mm-hmm. There was a debate within the administration. I think almost all senior cabinet officials felt we can't afford a break with Saudi Arabia, and this would mean a break. So what President Obama decided was, let's help Saudi Arabia, but let's sort of try to cabin our assistance. Our support is going to be for anything that defends Saudi Arabia's sovereignty and respect for the territorial integrity. So if the Houthis start launching missiles or incursions into Saudi Arabia, we should help them. But let's not be a party to the war against the Houthis. I think on paper that sounded right. No. I think in practice it just became impractical. We were refueling Saudi jets and Emirati jets. We were sharing information with the Saudis. We tried because, as you said, a lot of the Saudi strikes ended up killing civilians. So the Pentagon was in the operation room with them, giving them no strike lists, mm-hmm. which the Saudis either ignored or simply didn't pay attention to or made mistakes. So we ended up, in the eyes of Yemenis and others, being complicit in strikes that hit hospitals and schools and civilians. And so we tried to draw that line. I think what we learned, and we can't tell you how many hours we spent negotiating with the Saudis, giving them, telling them, here's what you can do, here's what we can't do. By the fall, the last fall of 2016, we started withdrawing some of our assistance to the Saudis at great cost to our relationship, but we stopped providing them with some of the precision-guided munitions, which they were not using precisely at all because they were bombing schools and hospitals. Yeah. So, but, you know, by then it was late. It was in the fall. And so I think there are lessons to be learned. But it's always, and, you know, anyone who's been in government, we know this, it's always hard when you have an ally to know who is dependent on whom. Right. Because, you know, you don't want to lose a critical ally, so you end up sometimes being as dependent on your ally as the ally is on you.
Yeah. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Rob Malley. He's CEO of the International Crisis Group and a former senior director of the National Security Council under President Obama. And now back to our conversation. Now, we had other reasons for being focused on Yemen, and that was the presence of al-Qaeda.
Yep.
To what extent did that draw us in?
Well, we had been involved in with the preceding president, President Saleh, then with President Hadi, our priority with Yemen, and it's one of the characteristics of U.S. policy about which I've written and I'm going to be continuing to write, which is our fixation on counterterrorism, which I think distorts a lot of what we do, and I'm happy to talk about that as well. But I think in this case, our interest in Yemen was about the fight against al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And so what we really wanted to do was make sure that we had a government in place or the authorities in place that we could continue our drone strikes against Al-Qaeda in Yemen. So we were already drawn in, and once the war against the Houthis began, our priority was still, let's make sure that we can continue our fight against Al-Qaeda. And one of our concerns was that everyone is going to be distracted and the focus would be on fighting the Houthis, and Al-Qaeda would take advantage of it, which has been the case in some instances, not you know, this other cases where the battle against Al-Qaeda continued. But yes, that was our interest, our first, and why did we invest in President Saleh despite all of his huge flaws? It was because he told us, I'll help you fight Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And that, again, those are those relations of dependencies. It really distorts our policy because we end up sort of subordinating other interests to this fight against terrorism and partnering with allies with whom we have very little in common except this so-called common fight against terrorism.
So I remember that Secretary Kerry, in the final years of the Obama, or months of the Obama administration, sought to mediate a solution to this war. And the clock just ran out, among other things. Is this, who has the power to end this war?
So Secretary Kerry, in fact, started very early on. I mean, he was our mediator in chief. You know, he was an unbelievable. I don't know when he slept, but every issue he wanted to mediate, and particularly in the Middle East. So he was focused on this early on because he did feel that it was distracting, that it could cause a conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and it could drag us in, as people might forget. But under the Obama administration, we took strikes against Houthi locations when they had attacked our ships. Yep. That could have gotten us into a fight with Iran because they were supporting and they had some presence in Yemen. So he was involved early on. I think several things happened. Time ran out, but I'm not sure that's the main thing. I think the main thing is the Saudi perspective was, we will, and again, we're guilty of the same thing in Vietnam and other places, and Afghanistan and Iraq. We'll negotiate when we're in a position of strength. Let's rebalance the situation, and then we could have a deal. But we're not going to deal with the Houthis when they control most of the country. So let's roll them back. They're also, and you know, so that was one big issue. I think they also what happened towards the end. You know, once President Trump was elected, obviously, and that's a big push that Secretary Kerry was making in 2016. Once President Trump was elected, I think a lot of the sort of the air got out of this because the Saudis felt they were going to wait for the next president who they thought would be more supportive of their agenda.
And so, has it been?
Sure. I mean, I think President Trump came in, and one of the things he decided to do was to, and again, I'm going to try to be fair to the way he would put it, reestablish and restore our relations with some of our allies, which had deteriorated, Saudi Arabia and Israel first, and Egypt, probably the three that he mentioned most, because we had differences with them. I mean, the alliance was still strong, but we did have differences with them. They were beginning to lose faith in us, and he wanted to change that. And so in Saudi Arabia, he said, we're with you in the fight in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
That even that might have changed, because I think, you know, people, officials in the U.S. government see how that war is going. They see it's not ending quickly. They see the humanitarian cost. So, you know, how much more patient they will be than the Obama administration was, we'll have to see. But so far, they have given more support. I think press just revealed the other day that we have some of our personnel, our armed personnel, in Saudi Arabia helping them.
Green Berets.
Green Berets, exactly. Yeah. So it is more, you know, our alliances and the criticism has been much more muted. And the forms of the assistance that we withheld from Saudi Arabia has been restored.
Right. So Yemen is a case where, I mean, it did have petroleum production. It's a case of a country that was initially destroyed by just bad governance, right? Inept governance, corrupt governance, kleptocrats, and, you know. And as you look at the other, you referred to four famines. As you look at the other ones, is that at the core as well? You've got South Sudan. It's on the Nile. It's got extraordinary minerals. It should be a wealthy country, albeit tiny, but extraordinary resources. It faces a famine. Somalia, a famine. Northeast Nigeria, a famine for the portion of Nigeria that feels ungovernable. Say something about what is the human cost here, and what is it about each of those examples that put us in this place?
So first, I realize I didn't answer fully your last question, which is, who holds the cards?
Who can end it?
So, you know, crisis group, we work with convicts around the world, and a lot of them seem intractable, and, you know, some people lose faith and hope. We try never to. In the case of Yemen, we actually think, and we've written about it, there is a pragmatic solution that would meet, well, what is Saudi Arabia's interest? Saudi Arabia's interest is not to have an enemy entity on its southern border,
and not to have
chaos. Iran a president on its southern border, not to have chaos, protect its border. What's a Houthi interest? The Houthi interest is to have, to make sure that it could protect itself and have, let's be candid about it, they want disproportionate power given their population, but they feel like they want to have more power than they have to protect themselves and to make sure that no decision is made that could ever hurt them. As you know, so they've been in the civil war with, they've had several wars with the central government. So the solution, which is one that Secretary Kerry and others have been trying to push, is the Houthis will need to cut their military ties with Iran. They're going to have to give away their heavy weaponry, but in exchange, and they're going to have to obviously commit, get rid of their missiles and commit not to attack Saudi Arabia, but in exchange, they would get a guaranteed role in the government and in the security services so that they won't feel threatened again as they have in the past, and they feel like they would have the ability to defend themselves. That's not a zero-sum game. That is doable, but both sides have to be more realistic, and outside powers, principally the U.S., you know, which country can now do it? I'll give this to the Trump administration. They have better relations with Saudi Arabia, better than the Obama administration had. Better relations, more support, that should translate into more leverage. They should be able to convince the Saudis, now's the time, and they say we'll put pressure on the Houthis, but now's the time to come to the table, accept a realistic deal in which the Houthis will have a role, but they're going to have to break their military ties with Iran. And, you know, without getting into the history, the kind of Shiism that the Houthis adhere to, the kind of Shiism that Iran adheres to, are different types. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And historically, they have not been that close. Mm-hmm. So this is not like, you know, a match made in heaven. There are ways of what they, this is a local organization, locally rooted with local interests. It's doable. But the more this goes on, the more the enmity, animosity between the Houthis and the Saudis grows, the more the Houthis will be close to Hezbollah and Iran, and the harder it's going to be to break. Yeah. Ask your other question. You know, most of these cases, when we look at them, so many of these, they are humanitarian catastrophes that are caused by drought, climate change. The ones you mentioned, and so many of these humanitarian catastrophes that we see, are made by men and women, more often by men than by women. They are related to conflict, which is what our organization looks at, which is what are the roots of these. They're political decisions that are made. Humanitarian catastrophes sometimes serve the interests of parties at war, because economies of war develop. And economies of war mean that there's scarcity for some and there's plenty for others, and those who are behind the scenes can control who gets what, their power gets increased. And so, you know, you mentioned some cases, we could talk about the Democratic Republic of Congo. May not be famine, but what a miserable situation for a country that is so wealthy, and the kleptocrats and others hold on and benefit from the misery of others. So it's really as a matter of political decisions that are made. Yes, we need to provide humanitarian assistance, and Yemen certainly needs it, as do Somalia, as does Sudan, as do South Sudan, as does Nigeria. But those are band-aids. They're important band-aids. It's political decisions that have to be made about governance and malgovernance, but also about conflict and the use and misuse of humanitarian assistance and of humanitarian disaster by parties for whom it serves their interest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what we're about. And so we try to talk to the parties and all parties and say, and try to understand how do we map the conflict? Who's benefiting? Who's behind it? And what are pragmatic solutions that meet the pragmatic needs of the parties? Some entities are going to suffer. But for most of these conflicts, you have to identify what is the sort of zone of possible agreement, and then simply focus on it and have parties like the United States and others that push them.
Let me take you, some of our questioners take us to Syria, another country in the region where Iran is playing a role, where the humanitarian disaster is pretty horrifying. Was there an opportunity early on for us to intervene to prevent this war from from growing this large, but just to nip it in the bud.
So of all the issues that I worked on, and I worked a lot on Syria, I only joined in 2014, so I wasn't there early on, but still it was none to this day give me as much heartbreak and make me question, you know, did we do the right thing? Could we have done something different? So I'm going to start, I have to start, not just with modesty and humility, but also a sense of guilt. You know, we weren't able to make the situation better. Could things have been different? And I think, you know, I to put my cards on the table, I'm not a big proponent of U.S. military intervention in the Middle East, because my experience has been that it almost never ends up well and almost always ends up producing the opposite of what we wanted it to produce. And you could look at Iraq, you could look at, you know, our experience in Lebanon, you could look at our experience in Libya. I mean, there's so many cases where sometimes well-intentioned, sometimes not well-intentioned, but military intervention in a region that we don't understand that well, that doesn't have a particularly favorable impression of us, where we often make mistakes in terms of who we back and people who we back, we end up hurting. People who we want to hurt, we end up helping. So there's a whole history there. So I start from a premise, which is I have a pretty high threshold before we're going to intervene militarily. It doesn't mean never, but it means think hard. When I look back at what happened in Syria, here's where I think, and again, we could spend hours and hours talking about it, but here's where I think one of the original sins, if that's the word, was made. And obviously, the original list of all sins is Bashar al-Assad and the way he treated his population. If we were going to intervene in some way, the goal should have been, in my view, humanitarian goal. We should not have been in the business of politics, of regime change, of saying we're going to back these to overthrow those. It should have been, if we could have, to cabin and said our goal is simply to stop certain egregious humanitarian abuses, chemical weapons, use of barrel bombs, etc. And that's it. Unfortunately, and maybe this is inevitable, maybe what I'm going to say is going to sound naive, maybe it's inevitable that all this gets mixed up with the politics. But as soon as, and this is very early on, our partners and ourselves were saying that the goal is to topple the regime in some way. Mm-hmm. Bashar has to go. We're supporting the opposition. The Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris, and us are giving material support to the opposition. At that point, it becomes an existential struggle for the regime.
Yeah.
Iran's involvement becomes automatic. Russia, Hezbollah, it becomes something where you can't distinguish the politics. We are then associated with countries whose intentions are not humanitarian necessarily. I don't want to name names, but for some countries, it doesn't matter how many Syrians die. What matters is that Iran was going to have to be kicked out of Syria. Okay. And I think once you mix those two, the humanitarian and the political, then intervention becomes something that I find extremely difficult and almost endless. I mean, you know, the Syrian regime and its allies would have fought tooth and nail because it became a strategic stake for them. If Iran to have lost Syria meant that it had lost its main and perhaps only ally, state ally in the region. For Hezbollah to have lost the regime in Syria meant that it lost its lifeline. So they were going to fight and they were going to invest personnel and money and resources. And Russia also was going to stand against it because they don't like this notion of regime change for their own reasons. So it's that commingling of the humanitarian and the political. If it was possible to rewind the clock, and if it was possible to simply say, the politics, who rules Syria, that's not our business. What is our business and the international community's business is how you wage your war. And when you wage war in violation of international principles, the laws of war, then we're going to have to step in.
Was the Trump administration right to do the military strike after the use of chemical weapons?
You know, you could debate it. Is it right legal? Is it right politically? I'm looking, you know, it's not, I have no, it doesn't pain me vis-a-vis the regime. So I'm not, you know, I have no regret vis-a-vis the regime. Was it an effective strike? I mean, that's the first strike was followed a year later by the use of chemical weapons, actually the first use of sarin against, if the counts are to be believed, against civilians since 2013. So obviously it wasn't that successful. Then it was the last military strike was done in a way that, I have to say, didn't send the strongest message to the regime, although I will give this credit to the Trump administration. I'd rather they did this the way they did it, which was modestly, which was sort of cabined, which is warning the regime or warning the Russians, rather than risking a war that could have really gotten out of control. So, you know, I don't feel like it's not a game changer. It doesn't answer the question of Syria. I mean, things were terrible before, they're still terrible now. I think we have to take a step back and think, how is there a way to have rules of the road about respecting the laws of war without politicizing it, but just respecting the laws of war in a way that is clear and that makes sense? We're not there yet. And so I don't really want to criticize the Trump administration because I don't think we found the better answer either. Right.
I'm going to take you halfway around the world to where there is another rule, and that is against ethnic cleansing, against genocide. And we have the case of the Rohingya in Myanmar being brutalized and pushed into Bangladesh, a very poor country. What is the sort of state of affairs right now? Is there a way out? What should the rest of the world be doing in the face of this?
So, I mean, yes, about 700,000 Rohingya were forcibly forced to flee their country. They were already many there, so let's say almost a million people in refugee camps in Bangladesh. Probably the worst refugee situation, or certainly the most, one of the largest refugee situations in the world, happened so quickly. So what's to be done now? I think, you know, we have people who are working in Myanmar and in Bangladesh, and their conclusion is, these people are not going home anytime soon.
No. No.
And however much they should be entitled to go home, however much it should be the goal, it would be a mistake to try to accelerate that, because they would be forced to go there against their will in situations of insecurity where they wouldn't be able to live safely. So the priority now is, other than putting pressure on Myanmar and holding the government accountable, that's number one. And number two, making sure that, because there still are Muslims still living in Myanmar, making sure that they don't become the next victims. But the real priority is making sure that the people who are living, the refugees living in Bangladesh, have decent living conditions, and that they not be forcibly sent back, and that the assistance be given to them. You know, the monsoon season is going to be terrible. So there needs to be a focus on making sure that they can live, you know, normal lives. That's a high standard. They can live decent lives. And, as I said, the other two steps, holding the government accountable. Why? Not because they're going to change their policy. Unfortunately, the policy, the brutalization of the Rohingya, is very popular in Myanmar. You know, narratives have been fed, and so the popular opinion is not at all against it. But holding them accountable, again, for a humanitarian reason, to make sure that other countries know there's a price to pay for this kind of behavior, even if it's not going to reverse the situation there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even within Myanmar, they're essentially in internment camps. What is... You know, how safe are they there?
So, I mean, they're not safe in the sense that there's been growing sort of resentment, ethnic and religious sectarian resentment against them. That needs to, you know, the government has a responsibility. Hopefully, it will meet it. That's not, you know, it's not a government that has acquitted itself particularly well so far. But you know, there's tensions between Buddhists and Muslims, and so yes, that's why I say that one of the things that the messages to the government in Myanmar is to tell them there are still people in your country, they need to be protected. Mm-hmm. Whether they live in Rakhine State or whether they live elsewhere, they need to be protected from certain state brutality, but also brutality by non-state actors,
various militias, etc. Two of our question cards take us back to the situation, back to the pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. As you recall, that a few years ago, when Benjamin Netanyahu was so vociferous in his opposition to the deal before the deal was negotiated, he was opposed to it, came and addressed our Congress to say that the deal that will be negotiated will be no good, and which must have reassured you as one of the negotiators to have that capacity to look into the future.
We watched that. We were negotiating at the time, and the Iranians and others, we all watched Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech together. So
that was
quite a moment.
I don't know what I think of that. So, but at the time, the alternative that was discussed was bombing Iran, bombing its capability. So I have a couple questions about that. You know, the first is mine, and the second came from the audience. And mine is whether technically we were in a position to be sure that we could, in fact, eliminate their whole capability, that we had that kind of precision and knowledge. Number one, and the question from the audience is, now that the U.S. is withdrawn, Will Israel and maybe even Saudi Arabia begin to think that bombing is a good alternative?
So first, as we speak tonight, there's a potential war brewing and starting already in Syria, I mean, between Iran and Israel. Earlier today, and the sequence is still unclear, but as you may recall, Israel had bombed Iranian sites or presumed Iranian sites in Syria. Weeks ago.
Yeah.
Iran had vowed to retaliate. How things started today is not clear, but there seems to be an exchange of fire and a barrage of missiles in northern Israel, maybe in the Golan Heights in northern Israel. Again, it's still the fog of war. And Israel has accused Iran, for the first time, it has accused Iran of having launched those missiles. And they're saying now, as I was coming in here, Israel is saying that their operations against Iranian targets are ongoing in Syria. So we could, forget about bombing Iran, we could right now be on the verge of an escalatory cycle between Iran and Israel, not necessarily precipitated by the withdrawal from the JCPOA. I don't think that helped, but this was more, and again, we're not in a position to play a role of mediating because we don't talk to the Iranians. Mm-hmm. That contact between Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Zarif, which helped us in some instances, that's gone. So, you know, I don't know. The only country today that could step in to mediate is Russia. Prime Minister Netanyahu actually is in Moscow at this time. Let's hope that he can get both sides to calm down. So your question, you know, you never know. You don't know what you don't know. I think we have pretty good intelligence about Iran. So I think we could have certainly set their program back. But I think most experts, including the Israeli experts, were saying this is what they call to mow the grass. Yeah, you could have set it back for a year, and then what, a year later, 2 years later, you're going to have to bomb again because you can't destroy knowledge. You can't destroy the capacity that Iran has. I mean, this is now, they've mastered the ability to enrich uranium and to build centrifuges, so they will be able to do it again. And unless, and then they'll try to dig deeper underground to protect it from whatever weapon Israel or we may have. So I think it could have been done, and President Obama was prepared, what he said, he was prepared to do it if it came to that, but it's not the best solution. And then you don't know how Iran is going to retaliate. And they are experts at asymmetric retaliation, so they could have attacked our soldiers in Iraq or elsewhere. So, you know, that was not the preferred option. I think our military leaders certainly were clear about it. Is that option back on the table? You know, putting aside the situation in Syria, one of the risks about where we are today is let's assume that the Europeans, despite their best efforts, can't convince the Iranians to stay strictly within the deal. Let's suppose Iran tomorrow says, okay, we've been enriching at 3.67%. We're going to go back to enriching at 20%. Let's suppose they say, we're now going to install our more advanced centrifuges, which they're not allowed to do under the deal. Let's suppose they expel the inspectors. At what point does that become serious enough for either the U.S. or Israel to say, wait a minute, we're going to let them, that breakout timeline we spoke about earlier, right, back down to 2 months. Then we're going to tell the Iranians, oh, no, let's come back to the table and negotiate. So if we have cut off that possibility of negotiating because we've just convinced Iranians that we're not trustworthy, and you know, why would they negotiate with us again? What will we do if they creep up? At what point will we say enough is enough, and then what? So that, I don't know that anyone is thinking about it today, but it certainly is a risk that didn't exist a few weeks ago and that now is back on the table.
Well, on that not very cheerful note, sorry, I want to thank Rob Malley, the CEO of International Crisis Group, and thank the audience. You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Rob Malley. He's CEO of the International Crisis Group, and he was a senior director of the National Security Council under President Obama. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.